Professor Paula Reavy. Thank you also for coming over from London, Paula. Paula is Professor of Social Psychology at London South Bank University. I guess I first got to know Paula through her work on memory, which is an extraordinary mix of different methods. Paula's also written a lot about methods in psychology and social sciences. The work on memory, much in collaboration with Stephen Brown, is remarkable for its attention to difficult pasts. One of her books is called Vital Memory and Affect, Living with a Difficult Past. Really experience near analyses of people finding creative and resilient ways to manage tough pasts and tough places. And the link to place and space is more of what we're going to hear from you today. Paul has also worked a lot on mental health and institutional space, which is her topic today, spatial markings and memory. We can see mental health and institutional space. Thank you, Paula.
Thank you very much, John. And thanks so much for the invitation. And it's lovely to be here in such opulent surroundings, especially as it gives me a good excuse to dress like a French duke, which is always a really good thing, and to get away with it. So as John mentioned, I'm going to be talking today about a specific project around the issue of institutional space and how it emerges through memorial engagement. The work I've been doing for the past 20 odd years has been really sort of focused on the sort of impact of the scene and the setting and the context of memorial engagement, and in particular the impact or the sort of emergence of the scene through autobiographical memory. So rather than measuring memory, I've been interested in how people remember and how they make meaning from that sort of process of remembering. So it's a kind of qualitative engagement. It's interested in meaning making. It's been very influenced by disciplines such as phenomenology, as well as social and cultural psychology. But really, the idea is to understand the interrelationship between the world and the mind as it emerges in memory. So, as I've mentioned already, one of the things I'm going to be talking about today specifically is looking at memory practices in institutional spaces. And as John mentioned already, a lot of my work has been around the concept of what is mental health, how does the scene and the setting sort of influence how we understand mental health challenges. And I'm going to be talking about specific examples from secure services today. So people who have been in institutional care for quite a long time. We're talking about people with very complex histories, very traumatic histories, and where memory has high stakes because of the kind of traumatic, difficult nature of those memories. But I'm also going to be drawing on work that I've done in general psychiatric intensive care units, also child and adolescent mental health units. And by and large, I'm going to be talking about, methodologically speaking, work using qualitative methods. I'm also a visual methods researcher, in the sense that I'm interested in people using images and bringing the space of their world into the research process. So rather than just relying on qualitative interviews, I invite participants to take pictures, draw pictures. We're going to be talking today also about the creation of diaries within institutional spaces as a means of eliciting sort of memory practices. So it's a qualitative endeavor. And I think 20 years ago, that used to be seen as a very odd thing to do. And I suppose you would describe me as a rather odd psychologist, but that's okay. But I think by and large, in the UK at least, qualitative methods have started to be seen as part of the sort of picture of how we should understand human beings and what they do, and to see that as a methodological sort of integration. The other thing I wanted to say was that some of the work that I've been doing has had a direct practical impact. So I've generated over the last 8 years commercial books that are used by architects and designers to influence how they basically build the built environment. So people who are building hospitals for mental health care, people who are designing features of mental health care to better promote recovery and healing. So I've become a director of the Design and Mental Health Network in the UK, and we've been producing publications that bring together psychology and design and architecture to help designers and architects think about not just building container spaces for mental health care, but also to think about some of the psychological features of mental health care, such as thinking about not just physical safety, stopping people from harming themselves or killing themselves, but thinking about psychological safety as well, right down to the sort of very specificity of how we design doors and windows. And I think I now know more about doorknobs than I think any human being should really know. But I think it's important, because what we've noticed over the course of our research is that, you know, people shutting a door on somebody is a really dramatic act. And it can sort of have direct impacts on how that person then interprets what is being done to them and how they should interpret and make sense of their distress and the reason why they're in hospital in the first place. So doors are really important, windows are really important, and these books are part of the way into an understanding of how we translate some of our theoretical ideas into practice. So that's another sort of aspect to the work. Before I give an example of how memory practice are enacted in institutional spaces, I just want to take a slight whistle-top store sort of tour through my theoretical orientation. And luckily, I've had some great people already talk about some of the theoretical principles underpinning their research, which actually seem to translate into mine as well. And Andy just gave a marvellous introduction to the idea of minds and worlds seen as an interrelationship, as one. And so the reason I started to become interested in how mental health challenges should be seen as interrelationships between minds and worlds partly was because of the individualistic nature of how people were making sense of mental health challenges. And in the UK, I think we're slightly less individualized. Certainly over the course of the last 20 years, there's been an understanding of mental health challenges coming from traumatic histories, social determinants such as poverty, discrimination, and so on. But there's still a real attention to what's going on in the skull, what's going on in the mind, what's gone wrong with the person, and how do we make sense of that. And I think for me, as somebody interested in phenomenology and social constructionism, I wanted to sort of bring in the world, to sort of see the environment as a rich source of information that would enable us to understand how distress emerges, but also plays out and is managed by people. And I think this quote by Bateson for me really sums up the kind of parameters of our search to understand not just the person and the boundaries of the skull, but also to think about the world as it is enacting upon the person, so that we take not just the man, but the stick, the street, the whole world itself as a source of information. Similarly, both Steve Brown, John Sutton mentioned already sort of Steve Brown, but Steve Brown is a co-author of mine and we do this work together, and that's really important to emphasise. But we've been interested in also the idea of affordances, how the environment itself provides opportunities for action. And in terms of understanding mental health challenges, that's really important to understand, for example, how experience plays out in certain settings, how it is shut down, how it is opened up in particular settings. And some of the work I've done around mental health and space has really explored that in much more depth. And we call this idea experience ecologies in order to, again, emphasise that the focus of investigation shouldn't just be the person and what's gone wrong with the person. It should be what are the limitations and possibilities in the world itself that enable that person to express distress in the way that they do. So that's another sort of feature of the work that we do. I suppose a sort of other influence has been the influence of process philosophy and Whitehead's idea of understanding occasions and events. So again, the idea that memory as a distributed expanded system has different logics and practices that move and change under different settings and circumstances. And again, this has been important for me in understanding the different epistemic variabilities in the way that we understand mental health challenges. So for example, mental health challenges can be understood therapeutically, but they can also be understood forensically and judicially, depending on if the person has committed a crime, and a lot of the people I work with have. So it's that sort of epistemic variability and tension that enters into the process of understanding the person's actions that have really influenced how I've understood the sort of event of the mental health challenge. Levine's notion of life space has also been important in understanding space and environments, not as just, you know, Euclidean notions of space as containers, but thinking about space as a form of relationality. How do spaces open up or close down forms of relationality? And how does that at a particular moment afford the person's greater movement within that space? So we've been interested in thinking about this idea of what possibilities of action open up or close down given the life space that the person embodies and inhabits. So what's the relevance to autobiographical memory? Well, I would argue that a lot of this material makes us think about that as we as persons are both the products and also the producers of a contextually grounded work of self-narration that enables us to see ourselves and create identities for ourselves that then help us navigate issues around responsibilities and how we understand our emotions, all of which go into then sense making around mental health challenges. Because a lot of people with mental health challenges will ask questions about how they can make sense of how responsible they've been in certain moments of distress. So the stakes around this are really quite high. And as a psychologist, this meaning-making practice is something of great relevance. It also must be that I'm going to have to put my glasses on, can't see. that the event in question may be a matter of record that is shared across a number of different practices. So in autobiographical memory, we have to account for this epistemic variability, that there are competing forms of knowledge when we're remembering that sort of can be in tension with one another. So again, it's understanding that the setting, the materiality of the setting, as much as anything else, is part of that sort of tension and epistemic variability as well. And I'm going to show some examples of that in just a second. There may be diverse concerns in any given moment in terms of how we represent a particular event. And as I've mentioned already, the work that we did on vital memory really emphasises the setting specificity of remembering acts. Sometimes people will be remembering events that have a therapeutic quality and a set of therapeutic epistemes that sort of orient them. But at other times, there may be issues of judicial responsibility that the person is embedded in. They may be in a courthouse accounting for their actions. And again, that sort of epistemic variability is very important for making sense of remembering in certain secure contexts that I've been working in. Another brand or strand of the theoretical orientation I've used is this idea of memory in the wild. And as you can see, that I pinched that from Ed Hutchins' Cognition in the Wild. But just to re-emphasize again, this idea that memory is a system, it's distributed across multiple locations. It's purely intersubjective. It's discursive. But it's also materially produced as part of the lived spatial environment. And again, as a psychologist, this has helped me think about not just the process of remembering itself, but also the process of how people become aware and make meaning of their own agency and responsibility, and how that's hooked into specific aspects of the environment, as we will come to see. So basically, this approach is an expanded model of memory, as we call it. It's situated in experience ecologies. And as I've already mentioned, it sort of goes beyond this idea of memory being inside the skull. It's an engagement with the world that's materially relational. The other aspect of it, though, is this idea of travelling memories. And when people go into psychiatric hospitals, they bring with them a series of objects and sort of engagements with space that travel with them. So we've been interested in this idea of travelling memories, which is the incessant wandering of carriers, media, contents, forms and practices that are undergoing an ongoing transformation through time and space. And so that the objects and spaces that we inhabit are part of the unfolding of memory processes. And this is where we begin sort of with this idea of travelling memories, that there, again, there are multiple forms of memory that travel with us and the medias that sort of inform that. And this is where we come to the sort of example of the hospital and the institutional space that I want to talk about today. Because what we find in psychiatric hospitals, and I think this is true across the world, and I have done quite a lot of nosing around how psychiatric built environments operate. There's this tension, really, between the building of environments, hospitals, that are container spaces, versus this idea of putting people in these spaces because we want to encourage healing and recovery. And often those two practices seem quite incommensurable. They seem quite at odds with one another. And part of the argument that we've made is that the materiality of the space itself is not fit for purpose. And I'm going to go on to give some examples of that. And part of another strand of that argument is that it's because those spaces themselves don't allow memories to unfold in a way that are scaffolded and enabled. They're often closed down and sort of closed off. And the reason I put this jacket on the screen, this is a jacket that was made in 1895 by Agnes Richter, who was an inmate of the Hubertusburg psychiatric institution in Germany. And what she did was she, as a way of sort of documenting her memories of being in the institution, she sewed into the jacket events that took place in the institution and her memories of why she thought she was there, memories, difficult memories, traumatic memories. And this artifact still exists as a way of really capturing that sort of the materiality of that memorial process. And interestingly, then a German psychiatrist gathered up all of these objects and displayed them in a museum for people to come along and look at, and to really sort of see the sort of material work being produced by the inmates as a record of their time in the institution itself. And I'm fascinated by this jacket because I think, as I say, it's a material representation of, you know, a set of memory practices that then live beyond that person. There's still sweat in the armpits. There's still this the kind of material record of what happened to Agnes. And one of the questions I'm really interested in is there a modern day equivalent of this needle and thread in public institutions for people with mental health challenges? And we shall go on to see what the answer to that is. The other aspect of what I've been interested in, as well as memory practices, is this idea of what happens to people in institutions when they're there for quite a long period of time. And a concept coming from social psychology is this idea of liminality, which is the process of being caught in between different states of being and different sort of states of memory. And I think it's interesting that in institutions, the project of stabilization in the present propels the individual into a state of liminality, because when the person is in the institution, they're often feeling as if they're never grounded. They're in between different boundaries of being well and ill. And this state of liminality is experienced is quite problematic. So this concept has been quite sort of important for me in terms of navigating my way through some of this sort of understanding of memory processes. And Stenner, for example, talks about liminal hotspots, when people get fixed and stuck in particular liminal states, and the possibilities for them being transformed by their current state is shut down. And partly this process has come about in institutions because the institutions themselves make it very difficult to access memory. And that may seem counterintuitive. You must think, well, people are in hospital to get better, so surely there are people talking to the patients about what's happened to them to make better sense of why they're distressed in the first place. And what we find in institutions is that is exactly the opposite of what happens, that people's memories are left to float and wander like spectres without any anchoring and scaffolding in the space itself. And I'm going to give some examples of that in a minute. So actually, memories become extraordinarily difficult to access in institutional spaces. And I would argue that this is in part due to the space itself, which the space is often sterile, it's blank, it's impersonal, it's literally built for cleaning and erasure of any kind of form of personalization and identification. And when you talk to people who are building hospitals and people who are in charge of the process, they will often talk about the fact that hygiene and infection control dominate everything. So whenever I've said, well, can't you put some carpets down in this hospital? Because actually then you wouldn't, you know, sort of get this sonic resonance where it sounds like a prison. And they'll say, oh, no, we can't put carpets down because if somebody throws up on a carpet, you know, it's terribly difficult to clean. So everything is wiped clean surfaces. So literally the built environment, the materiality of the space is built for this process of erasure, both physically, I would argue, and psychologically. So interested in this idea of being caught betwixt and between states of memory and imagination. And what we find through that is that the past actually stands still and becomes fixated. So you end up in a sort of state of liminal hotspot because people don't know what to do with these free-floating memories. The mental health care system has no sort of focus on the memory itself, has no sort of means of supporting people understanding it. Now, it wasn't always like this. And if we go back in time and look at the old asylum systems, which everybody bemoans quite rightly as being sort of inhumane and putting people away for years at a time unjustifiably, and that's absolutely right. But in these total institutions, what you get is a different form of record keeping, a different form of institutional memory practice. So in these grand buildings, what you do get are problematic practices, yet materially speaking, you have these rich clinical records that are highly narratable and that the patient's day-to-day sort of movements and what's happened to them is part of the clinical picture. And here we can see from an example in 1844 that there's a rich set of details around what's going on for that patient, their sort of memories about what's going on with their wife and all the things that are going on in the hospital during the day-to-day care. And I'm obviously not going to read this out, but you can see that there's lots of rich detail. And what we find today in the 21st century is that all that rich detail has been stripped out. And I would argue that the consequence of that is that everything sort of in terms of helping the patient navigate their own memories of the past, all of that sort of rich detail is stripped out. And all that person's left with is the project of present stabilization. We call it presentism because it's as if the past is erased, because the project of stabilisation has usurped it. So what you get is this kind of digitisation of the person's record and their memories, and it becomes condensed into a series of diagnostic categories. So in nurses' stations and institutions, what you see is people busy scribbling or typing, more like, symptom lists. Is the person hearing voices today? Are they feeling okay? What's their current state of mood? But there's no other rich narrative detail around that. And then that sort of symptom list is conveyed to the patient, and that's a way of doing memory together, this stripped down, very kind of reduced sort of set of practices. So contemporaneous memorial management uses these objects, and staff become custodians of memory in a way that really, as I say, condenses down. And the central project appears to be risk management. Is the person at risk today? And the patients pick up on this. I remember speaking to some young people who said, you know, they just come round with this tick list, and basically it's, do you want to kill yourself today or not? And they said that jokingly, but I think there's a real sort of poignancy in that comment. But really, sort of this whole sort of stripped out detail is important, because the modern system is based on diagnosis, it's based on abstraction, it's based on stabilization. And of course, medication plays a large part in that. It's stabilizing mood, it's stabilizing thinking. It's actually, a lot of patients describe, I don't really think about anything, because a lot of the things that were bothering me are suppressed, they're blunted via this process of stabilization. And of course, that's a material practice that has consequences for memory. And when we spoke to the patients about what they do with their memories in hospital, they were surprised that we'd asked the question. And as you can see here, they said that nobody's ever asked me this before. Nobody's really wanted to know what's happened to me and how that's had a bearing on my distress, which I think is quite worrisome. So I would argue that this idea of memorial practices is predicated on the sort of stabilization of the present and the negation of the past, and that it runs through and is enabled and afforded by the material practices of the hospital. It's also afforded by the types of therapy that go on in the hospital. So in institutions in the UK, the major therapeutic approach that's used with secure patients is dialectical behaviour therapy, which actively discourages rumination on the past and includes elements of mindfulness that are meant to facilitate being present. So this idea of actively displacing the past in favour of what's going on in the present is part of the therapeutic structure. So it's again, the sort of, it's enabling this sort of dispensing or displacing of past difficulties, so that they are deferred to much later or when the person's actually left hospital, if at all. And of course, that has sort of severe consequences for people's mental health challenges, in the sense that memories float about. They not only float about, but they float about the ward in ways that a lot of the patients find really problematic. You know, what do I do with these memories? And how do they collide with other people's memories that are going on the ward? And a lot of the time they talk about, I mustn't talk about the past because it triggers other people. And this triggering discourse is very much how memory is spoken about in the context of the institution. So again, as a psychologist, I'm interested in, okay, well, you've got this displacing of the past, so what? Well, I think it's so what, because it sort of has consequences on what possibilities there are for acting as a patient with mental health challenges. I also think so what in terms of how we build these facilities. The sort of whole ethos seems to be we build them like hospitals, we build them with no stimuli because stimuli is bad for people who are undergoing distressing experiences. There's no evidence for that. And it's interesting, we're doing a project at the moment looking at seclusion spaces. And I don't know if you're familiar with seclusion spaces, but they're often white blank walls, crash mats on the floor, no handles, nothing that can pose a risk to you. And when we've spoken to the staff, often they will say white walls are best for people when they're distressed. They don't allow people to sort of get overwhelmed. And of course, there's no evidence whatsoever for that. And actually, when people are highly distressed, what they really want to do is personalise the space to bring in soothing, sort of sensual sort of materials to enable them to reflect. And I would argue, materially speaking, these spaces do the opposite of that. They don't enable the person to reflect because the sort of sterility of the environment creates further harm and a lack of reflection. So patients often struggle to maintain connections to themselves. And also in terms of long-term institutional care, they've struggled to maintain connections to home as well. And I would argue that this is actually a key part of how we remember. So anyway, you've got that point. So just to give you some examples, lots and lots of patients talk about being discouraged from engaging with the past. And I've made this point already, but it is important to emphasise that the actual sort of atmosphere of the ward, the material surroundings of the ward, very much communicates a lack of engagement with the past. And the patients here really describe that. You know, I'm very good at blocking out what's gone on for me. And this was, you know, this is part of how the social spaces are used. And each patient is encouraged not to trigger other patients. And part of that is to close down memorial practices. So another project that we're doing is looking at social spaces and institutions to try and work out what goes on in social spaces, given that the past of the patient is encouraged to be displaced and negated. So that's another part of it. And lots of patients say staff tell them not to dwell on things. So literally do not live in your past, because what is important is the present and how that gets managed. And that, again, is part of the process of stabilisation and the importance of, you know, blunting and soothing and stabilising the person's mental health. And I think that's just the same point. The other point I want to make is the sort of material setup of how that sort of enables this process of literally forgetting the past. And a lot of the patients talk about, and you can see this is very typical of an institutional space in the UK. And what happens is people come out of their bedrooms, they either go to the social space or they go to therapy rooms and do group therapy. And one of the things that we've really noticed is that people get brought out of their room, they go down to group therapy, and then they get propelled back onto the ward. And here you can see an example of somebody saying, you know, you go to group therapy or you do art therapy, you splurge your guts, and then you are sent out of the room into the ward, and it's a sort of environment that is not conducive to the sort of, you know, to the aftermath of having engaged in that activity. So one of the things that we've argued is the architecture itself does not afford effective reflective capacity in unison with others, because everybody's sort of being put in a room and then put out onto the ward, and yet the ward isn't sort of set up to enable any kind of reflective action together. So we would argue that's problematic, and that's the building. There needs to be some sort of spaces in between that enable people to decompress after therapeutic activities. The other thing that we found is that as a result of all of this displacement of memory in the institution itself, people get stuck. They don't know how to reflect on their memories. They don't know what their sort of memories can offer them in terms of future facing prospects. And here we have an example of a man who's talking, he's been away for a very long time, and he's talking about his kids who he hasn't seen for like 20 odd years. And he's imagining them as small children still. And this was really common in the way that people were treating their memories. I want to give my son a hug. You know, he's sort of, I want him still to be little again. You know, I can't imagine him any other way. And I think this limited capacity reflection, these liminal hotspots that we see in these institutions, enable people to get stuck in sort of memory practices that are sort of basically, you know, frozen in time. I'll have to sort of skip through some of this, but what I want to sort of finish on is that service users are railing against, they're sort of railing against this. And what you find in institutions is people, you know, fighting against the sort of sterility of the built environment and the sterility of the materiality of the ward, and trying to inscribe in the building itself a sort of token and a memory of their existence on that ward. And here's some other sort of graffiti that I often find in hospitals, which staff have then bleached over, but are still there. And I think I want to end on a sort of more positive note, which is to ask the question, what might facilitate reparation then for these people who are hoping to enter a state of recovery, given that their memorial practices are curtailed by the institutional practices? How can patients de-paradoxify states of liminality? And to do that, I think that we need to turn to the material environment itself to think about alternative ways of setting up those affordances such that memory can be facilitated and scaffolded. And I think one of the ways that we do that is to speak to the people who use these services. And I work a lot with service users and patients who have thought a great deal about how to adapt old asylum spaces and create new forms of asylums. And part of this is to start to think about shared histories as part of the identity-making processes, a democratization of these spaces. Why do we have to build hospitals full stop? Apart from needing to measure people's blood pressure and so on, which could be done in a very small clinic room, why can't these spaces be utterly different? So I think it's about thinking about memory in different ways. Also thinking about why these spaces can't facilitate a collectivization of memories. Why do these memories float about in space in these highly personalized ways, when actually a lot of the people who are in these institutions share difficult histories? They share traumas that are similar to one another, and I would argue could learn from one another in creating better ways of understanding what's happened to them and how to move forward with that. And I just want to very, very quickly, if I have 1 minute, talk about a project called Mad Love, which is a project generated by service users who wanted to create a different asylum space. And they came up with all sorts of wonderful ways of connecting the life histories of people who enter institutions and making spaces that soothe and accommodate and create around that notion. And they worked with all the five senses, which I think is really, really interesting and important, because not just what does a hospital look like, but what does it sound like? What does it feel like? And we've written a number of papers about sonic atmospheres and how they are important in facilitating memory practices. But yeah, they generated an ideal asylum where they created pods and lovely grass and very soothing tactile different spaces that patients could use, that you didn't just go from your bedroom to the social space to the therapy room without any kind of channeling or sort of what the equivalent of a kind of compression space might be. They argue that all of that needs to be in the built environment itself. This is my favourite because if you remember the padded cell, that used to exist in UK institutions. This is service users saying, well, can we bring back the padded cell, actually? They were really quite helpful. But let's make them into nice colours that are soothing for us, where we can go in there and you can scream our heads off and shout a lot. And sort of transform this sterile space into one that really speaks to some of the rage and some of the distress that we feel as a result of the things that have happened to us. So again, it's linking up the life trajectory with the space itself. And this is an example of David Parkin, who's a service user, who's created his own seclusion space. As I say, they're very sterile often. But he says, why can't we bring into the space material objects that belong to us, that help us make sense of the stuff that's going on for us now? So again, it's bringing the artifacts of memory into the space to enable a sort of reflective capacity for the person. And again, this is a dragon cafe run by service users. And their whole project is about creating sensory material engagement. And I'm going to finish by just saying, for me, institutions, rather than enabling personal memories to float about like spectres with no harnessing, no scaffolding, why can't we use those institutions as a means of creating shared modes of remembering, living and imagining, such that memories don't get stuck? And they don't just sort of get sort of left to their own devices. We need to create new relational material spaces that undo liminal hotspots so that transformation is much more likely. Often people, you know, the problem is that people leave hospital and guess what? They come straight back in because nothing's changed. And I think that's partly because of the way that the built environment is and the reflective capacities for memories are just not there for people. And I think people feeling together with these mobile narratives, collectivization, is one way that we could do that. And let's draw upon the work conducted by mental health service users. They've got some great ideas, actually. And let's take seriously the idea that service users can be their own custodians of memory, and the role of the staff is to facilitate that rather than close it down. People are often in these institutions for 2, 5, 10, 15 years, and yet they're mostly relating to one another via TVs, and there's no opportunity for this kind of collective action. And I think I'll stop there.